particularly interesting in one way and simultaneously uninteresting because there's almost no halacha in it whatsoever. The first source is the tshuva of Rav Moshe, the only tshuva I know of Rav Moshe where he doesn't quote a Gemara. The only halachic, partially halachic source that he quotes is a Rashi in Chumash, which he then says doesn't apply. But let's backtrack a little bit and try to put it is an issue, and put it into some kind of halachic framework. Background. One, there are genetic diseases which hit particular segments of the community above others. And there's some in particular that hit segments of the Jewish community. Pesach is the one that people know about the most, which is a disease of infants where the overwhelming number of people who suffer from it are Ashkenazi Jews. There are other diseases that sickle cell ammonia is prevalent, genetic disease prevalent in the black community, things that are prevalent in the Jewish Sephardi community. There are many such things. They are different degree of being a of commonality. What percentage of the population has the missing the gene that makes it possible to have the disease? Essentially, all these diseases that emerge are diseases that at the present time modern medicine knows no means of curing. And the only way of dealing with it is preventive. I will use the Tay-Sachs as a classic example. It is a lack of a certain enzyme in Rabbi Bleich's piece in English. He discusses the whole process. It's very readable. It's a recessive gene. If a person is a carrier of the gene that could produce Tay-Sachs, nothing happens. However, if two carriers marry, so that means you have, both of them have this recessive gene, so one case out of four will produce someone who has the match. And Ahman would find if there's a match and get both genes for Tay-Sachs, such a child will get the disease automatically. As at present times, I said there's no cure. Child seems normal for the first few months, stops development, loses all its capacity to function, and dies a very painful death, usually around 2 to 2.5 years old. We don't have any cases of people surviving, even to a meaningful period of childhood where they can do anything. Child can talk, can communicate. It all develops diseases as soon as the thing locks in it for about 6 months, and then just decline and very painful death. Clearly, you can have nobody who has both genes giving them over to the next generation. They would have both genes, gets Tay-Sachs and dies in an instant. However, since there is no other consequence of being a carrier except the possibility of producing a Tay-Sachs gene, a person who is a carrier of that gene is not inferior in any way, is not subject to any other illnesses, weaknesses, the bacteria, anything whatsoever. Some even claim that stronger in certain ways, but that's but essentially it's irrelevant to anything. So theoretically, at least, if a technique had been developed to ensure that no Tay-Sachs children would be ever occurred, there would be no reason for an individual to be stigmatized by being a carrier, because the carrier per se is nothing. Carrier is only a problem to produce taste activation. That's important for the halakhic discussion. Now, we now know how to test people very simply discover whether they're carrying. Similar tests can be done for virtually every other genetic disease. So Tay-Sachs is just one case that we know about that affects our community, and therefore and many of us even know of the tragedy of the family that have had a Tay-Sachs and more than one Tay-Sachs baby. So it's very much in our mind, but the process, that same kind of blood test can test for many things, and as they progress, the process, they'll be able to increase steadily the number of things that can be tested, right? Which is a good part, but also make it complicated in another sense. Now, if a couple is not tested, there is no way of knowing that the infant was Tay-Sachs until after the infant was born, with one exception. That is, it is possible by a process called amniocentesis to get a little bit of cell tissue from the embryo and test it to see whether it's Tay-Sachs or not. The test for an absence of a certain enzyme, the technicalities of how the test works, is really not, you know, our business. It's irrelevant halakhically. Well, I shouldn't say 100. It's irrelevant except for the following. Number one, there is a percentage, a small, but a real percentage, of embryos which will be aborted because of the process. And that I just checked, I just had this Ricky White check for me, is affected by the how early in the pregnancy this process takes place. The later in the pregnancy the process takes place, the less likely it is that it would cause an automatic abortion, would indirectly cause an abortion. No one suggests, or almost no one suggests, that every single pregnant woman go through the process of amniocentesis to see maybe the child has, you know, is Tay-Sachs, maybe the child is sickle cell anemia, maybe the child is this, that, and the other thing, even though there are hundreds of genetic diseases. Because the risk of a pregnant woman having any one of these, losing an infant, with any one of these problems is far less than the risk of simply aborting the fetus by doing the process. So no doctor would suggest the process. However, if one had reason to suspect, that would be something different. Now, let's take the following scenario. Two people, one male and female, are tested, and they are both Tay-Sachs positive. And they get married. Even though they are both Tay-Sachs positive, they get married. The wife is now pregnant. She has, by the most elementary genetics, right? Mendel, she has one out of four, right? Each one is a positive and a negative. Positive and a negative, you figure out the statistics. It'd be two positives, one positive, one negative. Two A's is that way, and both negative. So one out of four statistically of the embryos will be Tay-Sachs babies. Now, since we're talking about odds not of one in a million, but one out of four, so then a doctor, essentially any doctor, who is not concerned about halacha would say, test the fluid in the embryo. Of course, this is a risk of one out of four. The risk that this process may produce inducing abortion is one in a million, I mean very, very rare. And this is a very significant, 1 out of 4, certainly a mere tamotu, that a rogue, significant minority. You know, Allah is in China, a very small mere than a mere tamotu, a real Muslim. What would be the result of that test if it was done on this pregnant woman? Well, if they were to discover that the embryo is a Tay-Sachs baby, the doctor then would recommend an abortion, saying, we know that this baby, according to all the knowledge we have now, we have nothing in the foreseeable future, no promising investigations, no experimental drugs, nothing that can treat it at all, will live this two and a half year life, pain and misery, nothing that we understand in terms of expression of life that would be meaningful, and with tremendous pain and mental anguish on the parents, which can have enormous repercussions. Now, halakhically, to do a procedure that can only lead to an abortion, assuming that halakhically the abortion is forbidden, would be also forbidden. Certainly so, if there is even the slightest chance of this process producing an abortion by itself, even with the slightest chance, if the process serves no other purpose, right? Because halakhically you can't do the abortion. And just the people should know, to salvage their curiosity, to find out now, or 5 months later, that certainly would not justify a process that could cause abortion or any danger. I have grave doubts whether that could justify any medical procedure, since there's always risk in a medical procedure, if it didn't produce a result that could be helpful to the person's health. And if the only way it could help the healthy was by performing an abortion, which would be usur, then all types of purposes doesn't help at all. The question of whether an abortion would be permissible in this case, I'm going to leave for a few minutes from now. But let's assume it's not, and there's only one posek who says yes. The Tzitzel, yes, the only posek who says yes. Rabbi Black discusses it. Though I was told by the head of Dar Yisharim himself, that in the Hasidic world, where apparently Pesach is more prevalent in certain parts of the Hasidic community. Remember, any disease that's genetic, that runs within a certain community, will find a more narrowly defined subset of that community probably more prone to it than others. And especially communities that tend to marry others within the same community, tendencies become increased in such a section of the population.
Just to clear up something, is the problem that I'm going to discuss now that the test itself?
No, the problem is that the only result of the test that's meaningful, besides having people know they could feel worse 5 months earlier, feel better if they are lucky and it isn't, is to abort. There's no other, because at that point, on the present knowledge of medicine, with an embryo three, four, five months, whatever it is, and we'll discuss that in a second, knowing that Tay-Sachs, we don't know anything to do with it. But a non-religious doctor will say you abort the pregnancy. Because Tay-Sachs baby has what kind of life? It's a life that's totally meaningless, in his terminology. And it's such pain for the parents, and you have no way of dealing with it. Why not abort before the embryo is born? It's going to be 2.5 horrible years for the parents. It could break up their marriage. It could psychologically damage them for life. An enormous cost to the population of using medicinal devices in hospitals that can be used for purposes that are more effective, he would tell, the doctor would say, abort, period. Now, if you can't, if we would accept the view halakhically that it's prohibited to abort, then we would, my next one would have to prohibit the test too.
Because
the only result you can get out of that test that's meaningful, the test one, any medical procedure introduces a certain amount of risk. Number two, this particular procedure does introduce the risk of an automatic abortion, even though it's very rare. For what purpose? If the purpose is worthwhile medically, it happens to be a very interesting halakhic shaila to discuss at someone else's and then we have on something else. The general question, I know there's a tshuva that goes back to my wife's grandfather. In his sefer, someone went to him and asked the question, can you perform an eye operation? Why? Every surgical procedure introduces some risk, the anesthesia, the whole process, going on the medical table of loss of life. You tell me it's a tiny, tiny risk. But we have a cloud to Pekuach Nefesh, even Sofek, and Zveik, to be balanced with an operation that's going to improve one's eyesight. There is no, at best we're talking about a Sakhanas Eivor in the operation. If the operation is successful, the operation fails, there's a fight by chance of loss of life, can an operation be justified? Obviously the answer is yes, you have to know why. That question gets, you know, stronger when you deal with cosmetic surgery, plastic surgery. There are truths in the literature on this question. But in this particular case, there's more than the general risk that any surgical procedure has. It's not a full-fledged surgical procedure. Here, there's a risk measured, they have statistics for it, of poking around causing the body to reject and to reject the embryo therefore causing an abortion. Yes.
Is it right that the Matthias says they can't do the test within the first 40 days?
I'm going to get to that. All right. Now, next question, before you get the test before they're married, is how early in the process can they do the test? Amongst the different data about abortion, there are halakhic sources which differentiate between the first 40 days and after the first 40 days. And there is one source which either does or doesn't, and I guess you read my last discussion of where the change of mind of Waldenberg about a Kabbat Yoyer that seems to differentiate between the first trimester and the second trimester. I asked Vicky Weiss about this procedure. He said it's normally done 16 to 18 weeks, which is the fourth month. So 16 to 18 weeks, he says he thinks, doesn't mean from conception, but from the last period. So halakhically, since we have to assume that the woman did not come pregnant until 12 days minimally after a period, because that's what she waited, 12 days before she had relations with a religious woman, minimally, so it's perhaps 2 weeks less than that, but it's still way past the trimester. He did say that there are people who now talk about in a book printed in 1989, so almost up to date, of doing it as early as after 10 weeks. But it does significantly increase the risk of inducing an abortion. I'm talking about an automatic abortion, not a desired abortion. And 10 weeks gets us within the 3 month period, it still doesn't get us within the 40 days. Is there a possibility that while I'm speaking to you, someone is discovering another means of testing that can be done within 40 days? Yeah. I do not know of such. I purposely asked to find out if since the last time I gave this lecture, the procedures had gone earlier in the process. Most poskim, and it's not an abortion shear, most poskim assume that this is not a legitimate reason to justify an abortion. I should modify that by saying that if in a particular case the woman knew she was a carrier, I'm going to give a slightly a variation on this procedure. A woman and a man and a woman get tested before they're married, and they're both carriers, but they decide to get married anyway. Someone recommends to them a week before they're getting married that they should test. They test, they get the results within the week of their chuppah, before their chuppah. They love each other, they've already committed themselves to getting married, and they just can't conceive, no matter what the circumstances, of breaking. I've been told of situations where engaged couples then went and got tested. And one of the questions is, should engaged couple that wasn't tested then go and get tested? Because some people then advise them to break up because of what could happen. On the other hand, if you're talking about an engaged couple, it's not a simple matter to tell a couple that's already, they made commitments to each other, break up because there's a problem, as you could well understand. Is then theoretically possible, and probably somewhat realistically so, that this couple, knowing that they're carriers, the first time the wife becomes pregnant, that either the husband or the wife, most likely the wife, but she's the one carrying the baby, will go through an extremely terrible emotional period starting on this, triggered by the fear that she's carrying a same-sex baby, coupled with the guilt that how they get married, if they, right? Then it is possible that a posek would commit an abortion because of the effect that it's having on the mother. To put it in another example, which is, I think, more likely than that one, that would be people didn't test. They had the baby, the first baby was tested. Sometimes it could happen two babies in a row. Now you can't argue with statistics that it's only supposed to come 25% of the time. Someone can have 10 children, not have any. You can have 4 children, and not want all of them to be tested. It doesn't work, you know. Statistics doesn't work that way in a particular case. Couple has a Tay-Sachs baby, it's devastating. And the mother gets pregnant, and she gets pregnant again. And they've gone through hell the first time, pardon the language. They've really got a terrible experience the first time. And it was very destructive to them. I could well understand a much larger group of poskim permitting after the second pregnancy, since they're supposed to have a second pregnancy, you shouldn't stop having children because of it, saying to test and then to agree to abort, since we know already the consequences of their having gone through it, and there's good reason to suspect that the consequences would be much more severe if it happened the second time. Now, but there are alternatives. The alternatives are obviously to test much earlier.
But in that case, are they taking it, also taking the parents' account or the pain of another baby?
It's the combination. Then you have, remember, in fact, very often, in order to arrive at a psak, it is not only one argument that's conclusive, right? In order to be matir something, if you go through Chuvis, you'll find very often a posek will only matir something because there's a combination of shittas and a combination of reasons that add up to a hetzer. Right? They won't always do it on the basis of one reason alone. Combination of factors. Now, I do not mean to tell you that most posek will matir in that case either. I'm just saying in the hierarchy of possibilities, and I really don't want to focus on the abortion issue because that's not my topic. Right? Just pointing out that there are different ways that the number of poskim would increase. I've been told by the head of Dar Yisharim, I started mentioning it before, that many Hasidic poskim will commit a couple that already has had a Tay-Sachs baby to abort, to test and abort if the next child is going to be Tay-Sachs as well. He's claimed from his own direct knowledge. I did not ask him which poskim. Not every psak gets written down. Now, he also pointed out, interestingly enough, something that doesn't get discussed in all the analyses of abortion, that there are a significant number of women who will not go through the process of having an abortion, even if someone told them that it was halakhically permitted, because there's a psychological effect on the woman of having the abortion too. Of a woman, you know, making a conscious decision to destroy an embryo within her. And while in much of American society or world society that seems not to be a difficult decision, people do it all the time, it happens also to be true that a lot of unwanted babies are born by people who know about abortion and chose not to do it. And I'm not only talking about frums, I'm talking about 16-year-old unmarried girls who go through with pregnancies not only because they're unaware of how one can get an abortion, or because it's illegal in a certain procedure in a certain state. Legal and aware, the people won't do it. And he said to me that even if we were passing that the abortion would be mutter, not everybody would do it also, and still wouldn't solve the problem. And frankly, most folks don't pass in a way. Yes. Yeah.
Theoretically, if there were a test you could do in the first 40 days, you think most folks would come out?
That gets us into the question, which I didn't really want to focus on, of how solidly we take the argument that the vlad is not a vlad in the first 40 days and we can do an abortion. Right? The one serious abortion shaila that I had to take to the Rav, which was an issue of the mental health of the mother, and she was suicidal according to the psychiatrist who was treating her, the Rav said that if another psychiatrist would agree with the prognosis, and they could do an abortion, and they should do it in the first 40 days, even though he doesn't think it makes a difference, because since there are posts who do things that way, you might as well, you know, do it in such a way as to get as many posts as possible. But I don't know if Rav posts say it right. For those who read Rabbi Bleich's shir last week, when he spoke about IUD, he did speak about the possibility, which he took very seriously, that as long as the embryo was microscopic, there should be no problem with abortion. Even though he said Allah will Allah ma'asa. But that corresponds exactly to 40 days and that I didn't really investigate. So there are a lot of things there. But let's move from that question to the one that's most common, because most persons don't commit the abortions and won't commit the testing to find out. Now, but there are alternatives. Why wait till the couple is already married, or even till the couple's engaged? Why not test earlier? And if one tests earlier, one can then... One, if a person discovers they're not a carrier, then that person has no problem whatsoever. Because even if a non-carrier marries a carrier, there is literally no possibility of producing a Tay-Sachs baby. There's a possibility of producing another carrier. But a carrier, as we said before, is not a problem, just being a carrier. A carrier is only a problem if the carrier marries a second carrier. And if the person discovers that he or she is a carrier, which they have a statistic of 1 in 30, right? So then that person would have to be careful before they got socially involved to find out that the other individual is not a carrier. And then again, there's no risk. And this way, you will eliminate Tay-Sachs completely by not having any carriers, man carriers. Because we're concerned that they're going to marry anyway. Well, that's true if you can talk about an engaged couple getting tested a week before they're married. But if a guy would have himself tested before he ever went out, and he finds out that he's a carrier, then he should be smart enough to make sure that he doesn't start a relationship with another carrier. Is it foolproof? No. Because, you know, the guy's walking the street, love at first sight, and he's not. Doesn't check. But it certainly reduces the percentage down to an absolute minimum. There are two ways this can be done, essentially. One is to get to your population at an early age where you have access to the maximum number of people. And in the religious community, that would, let's say, when they're in eighth grade, because in the process, more people go to yeshiva elementary education than high school or high school less than. Beis Medrash and for women, certainly the same. So, in the Orthodox community, if you were to test every boy and girl in the eighth grade of the day schools, you would blanket the community. I mean, how many Orthodox people, you'll tell me, yes, you know, and Avram Gordon looks at me and says, this is Hanford. There's no day school in Hanford. You're right. You will not get 100% of the community, but certainly you'll get 90-95%, right? Orthodox Jews who live in communities that have day schools overwhelmingly send their children to day schools. The percentage is a little less if you wait for the high school, and if you go beyond high school. Right. And that is one suggestion. Test every single kid in eighth grade. And Rabbi Bleich says, Halacha L'maaseh, this is the way to do it, and this is the only way to do it. And tell everyone the results of the test. Explain to them carefully that there is no stigma attached, there's no halachic problem in being a carrier. Because as I said twice before, and I'll say it one last time, the only consequence of being a carrier is the problem of marrying another carrier. But if a carrier does not marry another carrier, there are no health problems produced to that person by being a safe sex carrier. And essentially, this is true with all the genetic things he takes. Their only significance is when they come together and cause a problem in the infant. Yes.
The statistics as high as they are when two carriers marry, as far as the
gender. Right.
Is that marriage fully logically
justified? They're allowed to get married. People are allowed to get married if they can't have children. And yet 3 out of 4 children are going to be normal. Yeah. Now, Rav Moshe in his tshuva comes out strongly against this procedure. Right? Now, he could have given, he presents one argument that he rejects as a possible argument, and then an argument that he accepts. This is a very interesting tshuva. It's the only tshuva that I know of, Rav Moshe, which just shows you how little I know about all the tshuvas in which Moshe or the volume, in which Rav Moshe is not quoted at the moment. Doesn't quote a Rambam, doesn't quote a Shulchan Aruch. He does quote a Rashi in Chumash. Right? The Rashi in Chumash on the pasuk Tomim Tiyeh Mashem Elokecha. So, Hisalech imo b'tzmimus v'tzapelov lo tachkor achar asidah. He says, maybe what Rashi is telling us is you don't test for anything. You know, if you trust in God, you don't take any chance. The similar argument is discussed by Rav Moshe in his Truvis about insurance. Right after that insurance policy, it's a question of the Tachkor and Thomas Yimshal Kecha. And Rav Moshe rejects it. Says, Tomim Tiyeh Mashal Kecha does not mean that one can find out something. Now, one has a procedure to find out something, one should not follow a given procedure. It means one shouldn't worry about, you know, what if, you know, what kind of thing. But if there's a way of finding out in the same manner that the argument in Mizanot Shel Adam, Suvim Lav Rosh Hashanah and Rosh Hashanah, is not understood as saying, I'm going to sit in my room and I won't work, and since I promised money, it'll come from a hole in the ceiling. I don't see that halachic position. For us, Mechuyav to teach his son an umnis, because he has to make a living. If you don't teach him this, he'll be malachim et atriya. No, get it from the home, you feel it. In some chanes, you don't function that way a lot. So Rav Moshe mentions that argument and rejects it. Yeah? However, Rav Moshe is concerned about something else. If this information is public knowledge that someone is a carrier, and it's a sophisticated argument to say that even though a person's a carrier, it doesn't mean anything because it's only relevant vis-a-vis marrying another carrier, it could be a stigma, seen as a stigma for marriage, and it could also have a negative psychological effect on the individuals told that he or she is a carrier. And that is a problem. And since the number of people going to be carriers is by definition significantly higher than the possibility of carrier marrying another carrier, then we shouldn't test and have a significant percentage of the population stigmatized and facing emotional problems for that which only affects a minute percentage of the population. That's essentially the argument to be in the truth. Now, those who disagree, Rabbi Bleich, for one, dismisses the argument about the nerves and how people are going to be stigmatized by pointing out that educate your community that it's not a stigma. Right? Do like I did in the shiur, keep on repeating the fact that there's no stigma attached to it, no health problem, no other problem attached to it. And the isolated individual who can't hear bad news, well, that's a person with a psychological problem. He certainly should be dealt with. He or she should get psychological help. But there are endless ways that a person, you know, can get bad news, and people who can't handle it need psychological help. And the assumption that this is the only bad news that can, you know, trigger his nervousness or her nervousness, that something's going to happen in their adolescent years is absurd. There'll be something that will get them upset. They have that tendency. It's so nervous. Moshe obviously disagrees. Here, since I do want to get a little bit of halacha into this, a little gemara, I want to call it gemara somewhere. I want to raise the question if the question of stigma is simply a thought process of people who don't think properly whatsoever, or it's a real issue. So there's a gemara in Yevamos Basamach Dalet Amud Beis. In the sukkah about chazaka, the machlok between Rebbe and Shimon and Gamliel, you get a chazaka by doing something two times or three times. So the Gemara discusses a chazaka which does not come about through the actions of a single individual, but of a tendency in a family. Right? If something happens to three sisters, is it a chazaka as far as the fourth is concerned, that it's a genetic problem in the family? And the Gemara comes to the conclusion, yes, you do have a chazaka, which can be gotten from family patterns, not only from the individual. Yeah. Amar Rava, if that's the case, then a person shouldn't marry into a family that has various diseases that are seen as genetic. Talks about Nechpin, Tzorayim, and the Rambam brings it down in Yom Surah Bia as Halacha. Shulchan Aruch brings it down as well. Which means that one has a right and one should be concerned with genetic flaws in marriage. Now, how serious this take? Is it to be seen in the same level as the Gemara saying you shouldn't marry a Bas Amoret, you should marry a Bas Tamifacha, or you shouldn't allow your daughter to marry an Amoret? Now, it's also brought down the halacha, right? Or is it a real halacha in the sense that, you know, it's an Easter Daraisa or an Easter Daraisa, I don't know what kind of Easter it is. Is it advice? Is it a real Easter? What level Easter? It may be much more serious than marrying the Easter of having your son marry a Bas Amoret. There we have a pause who says it's because some Ratzim have are notoriously boors. Live a certain kind of life. If you knew that, and the assumption is that that had influence on the daughter, who's brought up in a home with no manners, with no knowledge of Torah, she won't be able to live an observant life, she won't be a decent person. If you know for a fact that the girl is a wonderful girl, and that she has, she developed qualities very different from her father, so then that problem of Basa Maris wouldn't apply to having her in heaven as. But here, it's talking about a genetic problem. Genetic problem is a genetic problem. Now, if Chazaka is significant genetically, certainly if you did a test and discovered a result, it's significant genetically. What if it was something that was not a recessive gene? That was a dominant gene. Right, this problem, by the way, has other ramifications. I mean, in the very sad ramifications. What do you do? There, many people, unfortunately, suffer from various diseases. And the question always comes up, is it something that is genetic? And therefore, you marry somebody with a genetic problem, then you have good risk of your children. And if it's not a genetic problem, then you know, it's an individual thing. Because of whatever reason this person has it. Of course, you realize the aim is of itself. And the little, but I see him. The little aside when I had stuff from amblyopia, the lady I know, genetic. Right? And I still married. One of our sons has amblyopia. Genetic. You don't get it in every case. Now, in this particular situation, you shouldn't be too upset, feel better. It's treatable. Once we were conscious of this possibility, the eyes are tested at a very early age. He doesn't suffer from it anymore. You know, dealt with a specialist, dealt with, he doesn't have it anymore. Even though I still suspect, in watching or our son looking at things, that his depth perception is not as good as those of his brothers because of some remnants of it. But genetic problem, as a children, you know, if you want to broaden it, and this was the story I was really going to tell, of the same son who inherited all my genetic problems, poor kid, was slightly asthmatic as a child, and asthmatic children tend to have many allergies. They all go together. And when we brought him back from the specialist to discover that he's allergic to this, that, and the other thing, and I was very upset because I was a major supporter of some of the allergy doctors in my community, in my youth, and missed by a very slight amount in joining a couple of friends of mine and spending the better years of their youth in Denver, where we used to send asthmatic children to the Jewish Hospital for Chronic Diseases. Somehow the doctor thought I would have growth, which thank God I did. Came home, and my wife brought him home, and her mother said, "Oh, it's all my fault because there's such a history of allergies in her side of the family, etc." as well. You realize that, none of us are genetically perfect. And, this can be taken to an absurd degree. But I did want to quote a Gemara and a Rambam. Yes.
The thing is that a taste like carrier
Exactly. That's the point I made before. But I just raised the question whether one has a right to be concerned halakhically with genetic problems. Yeah, as a preliminary question.
But even if one did,
this is absurd because it's not really a problem. Yes.
So if you're going to be talking about genetic problems, there are characteristic problems also that are
Well, yeah, no. There you certainly are concerned. I assume, I work with the assumption, and I am a very poor matchmaker, but I do talk to young men and women who are in the process of going out, that they do concern themselves with the qualities of character.
Right.
All right? And they do concern themselves with before they start going out, they would tend to consider the character in the family, right? Some went to you and said, I've got this most wonderful girl. I must tell you that her father's in jail because he's a bank robber, but she's different. Right? And it's very possible she is different. You would probably be hesitant in taking her out, right? Even though one doesn't inherit bank robbing tendencies. Clearly there are many things go into it. This has to be a genetic one. We do live in a community, and I don't want to dismiss Rav Moshe's arguments. We do live in a community that has gone absolutely crazy on this business. Now, particularly, I say community, I should modify it somewhat. The more you move to the right in the religious spectrum, if I can use that phrase that I don't like using, the more they're going back to traditional shidduchim. The method of shidduchim is a method which essentially tries to match people on the basis of families as much as the people themselves. And it's a method which historically always felt the shidduch of coming together families through these particular individuals. And I would get all kinds of questions about Charles and yeshiva. Do I know the parents? Do I know what kind of home he comes from? Do I know what kind of people they are? Usually I'm in luck, and if they're out of towners, I can say the boy came to yeshiva, was 18 years old, was 20 years old, they never met the parents, and boy functioned yeshiva out of context of parents. If they're New Yorkers, and I know the parents, so it's a bit more difficult. But there are people who ask that question, and they ask the question before they allow the first day or two. So, this was the procedure which simultaneously tests and tries to deal with all the objections of giving out the information. So what they do is that they test people at an older age prior to going out. They're going out already, as we pointed out. One has the additional complication that there's already, maybe already a relationship, and it's not so easy to break up a relationship that exists. Well, maybe not correct in breaking a relationship, because either way you want to formulate it. But to prevent the problem of stigmatizing and the problem of nervous reaction, the person is not initially given the result of the test. Takes the test and is given a number. When he decides he wants to go out, assuming that the girl was also tested in the same procedure and also has a number, which is obviously the assumption for this method to work, he calls phone numbers are given to him, and he says XYZ and ABC, and they will only, and they'll either say no problem or problem. Next.
Is that for both or just for that individual?
No. They will tell you if there's a problem between the two them getting together.
Both numbers will be given.
He'll give both numbers in. You give his number and her number, and they will only tell them there's a problem if they're both carriers. Now, it is true that if a person gets told it's a problem, he not only learns that this particular relationship is a both carrier, he will also learn that he who asked the question is a carrier too.
Right?
They can't be both carriers and one of them not a carrier. Right? However, again, it reduces it tremendously, because even if he is a carrier, if the girl is not a carrier, he'll be told no problem. No. Being a carrier, if he goes out with a girl who's not a carrier, is not a problem. What are the advantages of this method and this method? I'll answer the questions in a minute. What are the advantages and disadvantages? The advantages, of course, are for all those who are concerned with giving out information of tests of testing people when they're young and unable to deal with information. Testing at 13 years old, it's very hard to explain to them what it means to be a carrier or not. Kids can certainly jump on some other kids for something that's absurd because they're not mature enough to understand that it's absurd. I assume that everybody in this room was once 13 and can remember such situation where it didn't have to be logical that someone jumped from you are a no, an ex. However, in return, there's a tremendous practical difficulty. The practical difficulty is that if I tell each one of my sons, which he didn't do, any one of the tests for through Dari Sharim, and he was fainted afterwards. It did have consequences, but we know. But he fainted. If I would tell each one of my sons to be tested, and let's assume that positively I've discovered that none of them are carriers, then they would know for sure they're not carriers. They would not have to worry about the girl was tested or not. Once they had that information, they have it. It's true forever, and the whole process is gone. So in the small percentage of cases where one of them will discover he's a carrier, that happens. You notice they didn't say Rahman al Islam since he decided there's no problem in being a carrier. But one is tempted to say it. Think about it. If one is a carrier, then you have to be careful when he goes out. But if he's not a carrier, he'll be taken care of. If the person goes through the Dari Sharim test, so he has to, each time before he goes out, and we live, I changed the wheel a little bit from the priest one here. Most of us live in a religious world where people don't go through Shidduchim, and they go out with a girl, you went to something, you're working at this wine event, and you saw a girl advisor, and she made a very nice impression on you, and you say, look, I saw her, so I know what she looks like, I saw her functioning. That's again the idea of a character. I see that she's interested in doing kirov work, and that shows the kind of religious value she has. I have adequate information, then I'm going to go ask her out. So I don't have to go to her and say, excuse me, I would like to ask you a question. And she thinks she's going to ask her out, and say, can you give me a number? Right. And since a number of people go out with a significant number of girls before they get married, they have to remember to do this procedure every single time. Because even if every time they call 50 times, because I think women know, they call 50 times and get told no problem, each one of 50 times, that still doesn't prove that they're not a carrier. It might mean that none of the 50 girls are carriers, but he is a carrier. He still has to call the 51st time. Right? Now, in the Hasidic world, or in the Yeshivish world, with the Shatchanim, so that stuff can be done before the people even go out, because that's done through the Shatchan does all the stuff. Why? And in particular in the Hasidic world, the Yeshiva world is already less, where most often they try Shidduchim once, twice, three times, and that's it. They don't go out with many different people. So then they're talking about a procedure that has to be done just a couple of times. But even I know in the Yeshivish world, besides the YU world, many guys do go out with many different people, and if you do a procedure and you're careful about it, and you do it 20 times, you tell us no problem 20 times, it's not at all surprising the guy not to do it the 21st time. No. Even though the possibility exists that the person's a carrier, the girl's not a carrier, get tired of doing it and tell no problem. You sort of assume there probably is no problem. That's what most people aren't carriers anyway. Very small percentage. And lack the equivalent opportunity to test all the girls. Because let's assume that we, as we have done, we've introduced the test here in Yeshiva, and everybody which hasn't happened takes it, and they do the same, it's stern, and again everybody takes the test, and one fellow decides that the girl doesn't go to stern. Which happens all the time. So it's a community in which this procedure, because of its cumbersome nature, will not always be effective. Not because it's theoretically not foolproof, because practically speaking, either the girl won't be tested or the guy won't ask, or he'll start going out first because that's the way the community works. And once he's going out, he'll go through a very funny now asking the question. And his son is engaged now. You know, and best of my knowledge, he never dealt with this issue. I don't ask them. Whereas if I wasn't giving the shia, it wouldn't be on my mind. And now I'm giving the shia, and I think, well, maybe it should have been. Now it was already engaged. That's too late to ask them because that's going to cause him a problem. I opened another Pandora's box. Now, since my whole talk tended in the direction of saying that test them and test them young is openly the better procedure, that someone would have the right to ask me why I was one of the people in the Yeshiva who promoted the Darisha. But this is an interesting reflection of dealing with halacha that goes beyond the specific question. You have a halachic shayla, and you have many different people who pass in a different way on the same shayla. In this particular case, one even has two versions of why Rav Moshe passed. Because the tshuva of Rav Moshe seems to oppose the testing except on an individual private basis. No systematic testing at all. Zohar Sharon people, and I was very involved with one time, and Rabbi Tendler, who I spoke to a number of times, say that they went to Rav Moshe, and they have a statement for Rav Moshe saying that he favors their procedure, it meets all his concerns about it.
What was said so far? I mean, I've read it short.
It's very easy to read. That's a short tune in there. That's true. However, unfortunately, they were able to do this at the very last year of Rav Moshe's life, when Rav Moshe was not writing Shuvis, where his grandson, Mordechai Tendler, was writing Shuvis, and, you know, signing, saying, I spoke to my grandfather, and he agreed, and there are those elements within the community who question, Rav Moshe wasn't well, how do we know, they know that he understood fully what his grandson was saying to him, since maybe that doesn't prove Rav Moshe really felt that way. And I prefer not asking any questions about that. Use your own interpretation. Now, so we have the following situation. Let us say you heard my presentation and you say, it's obvious that the only, that in a YU kind of a community, where people go out and go with a number of girls, the only practical approach that's halakhically sound and helps to eradicate Pesach in the community would be to test all the kids in day school in the 8th grade and anyone who came to JSS who didn't have a yeshiva background, came to without a day school background, should be informed about it as soon as they join the community and advised to go to Mount Sinai where they test, get the results. And not to be concerned about the stigma, it's not a community to stigmatize anyone, not to be too concerned about the psychological consequences, because most people can handle it. If someone can't handle it, you counsel him. You provide people to counsel. If they can handle it, the other things they can handle just as well. That would seem to be the result. Problem is that if I got up not in this room with 25 people, but in the yeshiva based medrash, and I banged on the table and said, I want every single guy to go and get tested. Right? So instead of saying, the oracle has spoken, I trust that the fellows would then go back to their Rebbe this year and ask their Rebbe, do they agree or not? Well, chances are that some will say yes, and some will say no, and some will say maybe. So, when we had the opportunity of doing something in the framework of Yeshiva, also knowing that the first time this issue came up, apparently when I was not here at the time, Rabbi Black told them to test everybody and give them the results, and tend to tell them not to do so. And not wanting to avoid a repetition of that process, I went through a delicate negotiation process amongst the Rosh Yeshiva and got a consensus to either agree to the Gari Sharon test or at least agree not to disagree publicly. Right? So those who think that based on Rabbi Moshe's Pesach, we should listen to Rabbi Moshe, and other Rosh Yeshiva listens to the Sharebi to feel that the test should be private, are certainly happy with following their procedure. Those who think that we should test everybody publicly are not 100% happy. But I said to them, listen, we'll tell them that if they want to, they should go to Mount Sinai. I'm making them aware of it also. And you don't object that it's harmful to test this way. You just have practical objections that won't work as well. So they agreed not to say foolish. Even though one of them told me privately that it was foolish, because it's not going to work and you're wasting time and money for a procedure that's not going to have any result. And the small group who feel that the Havamin and Rav Moshe, Hashem is Psoim Hashem, Tantier Hashem Rokach, you don't do any tests, you don't stigmatize people, it's a very small percentage of the population, you just live your normal life and you don't enter in this. After all, there is a this is a very simple case, but once you start the process, I don't want to leave any position looking foolish. So there's much more to the position. The minute you start with genetic testing, why stop with one test? Then there's endless things you can test for. And then you can talk about genetic, all kinds of things where you're going to characterize people as genetically desirable and genetically not so desirable. And you could cause all kinds of consequences for the society, were making it very difficult for a substantial number of people to marry or to marry other people unless they're also genetically undesirable, which then simply increases the problem they have children in the genetic pool and genetic mix. Right? I was able to negotiate all the different people and get a consensus to accept this particular procedure. But very frankly, only a small number of students took advantage of it, so I don't know whether it was worth the effort. Okay, now it's over for a lot of questions. Yes, fine.
Yeah, according to your wife's suggestion, how does that eliminate all the problems? Does that mean that everyone will be aware of whether everybody else is a carrier also?
Well, it means that a person...
I mean, even if I know that I'm a carrier, I still will be very hesitant if I meet somebody to ask her whether she's a carrier or not.
Okay, but you're right. But if a person knows that he's a carrier, so then he knows that he has to find out somehow. He may be hesitant to ask, but if he doesn't ask, so then, we provide him the procedure. It's up to him. And the vast majority of people, of course, you say it's 1 out of 30. That means 29 out of 30 people are not going to be carried. Yeah, next question. Yes.
When you cut off the issue, they just say there's no problem.
They just say,
they will
say
about, if you are.
They will not tell you if you're a carrier or not. In fact, I was told by this fellow whom we spent a lot of time discussing this, that one particular Hasidic dynasty, the Rebbetzin called him up because she wanted to find out if her daughter was a carrier or not. He said, I'm the ex and ex Rebbetzin. He said, I'm sorry if I tell one person. Then I tell everybody and he refused to tell.
And the
rebellion
that are against it because they feel it should be public.
Well, some are against from one side and some are against from the other. Some are against and say that there should be public, person should be tested and told the answer is private. Right? Others are against it by saying the only people who should go to be tested are people who on their own feel that it's important for them to be known by the test. You don't want to make a procedure which opens up to everybody, hey, that problem, be concerned, right? Privacy. Don't get anybody upset, don't get anybody nervous. Don't make a big deal if someone feels character, carrier, feel bad. On a private basis, you know, if there's any reason to assume, because you know, a cousin, second cousin, something in the family, to indicate that someone might be a carrier, you suggest privately don't get tested.
It even caused the Russia with Dr. Schoenberg, supposed to be called and say, well, there's a problem. Doesn't that cause a... Well,
that's true, but if there's a problem and you get married, then it could one out of four children cause a much more serious problem. And that's certainly psychological as well as everything else. Yeah, I'll get to a little.
I'm a little concerned, I don't know if you would do it, but evidence that Facebook methods to guarantee that they're not distributing the sample, for example, the numbers?
It's done by professionals. It's not done by a bunch of Kiddush Yidden, you know, hanging around. The fellow who does the testing for them, here they did it in different the blood draw. They just did a little extra blood oil. They had a nurse do it. The fellow runs the chemistry lab who does it for them happens to be, we learned from Shiva together. I always thought he was responsible individual. He runs the lab. Yes, is there a risk that he mixes these samples up? Yes. Is there a risk that when you go to the hospital, Rahman was applying for a disease, and they test you, that they come back with a result from somebody else's blood sample? Yes. Everybody who ever took a blood test, anybody who ever, you know, didn't you ever worry, you had the right sample? Lab technicians make mistakes
everywhere.
Yeah, they don't take names. They learn to put down some symbol for you anyway, whether they put a name or a number or a card or a picture. It's all the same thing. Yes?
I mean, a guy can go to a hospital by himself.
Yes.
And find out if
it's that's right.
So why would, and also, you can't force anybody to get
the test. No. You're talking about. You're talking about making something available to people in large numbers. You have to publicize, right? I've got a simple question. How many people in this room went to Mount Sinai or any other hospital and had themselves tested to see if they were asymptomatic carriers? Not very sure. How many people in this room, not very sure, in the Shiva, but went to one of the hospitals, procedures available, Mount Sinai hospitals, and it's in the Upper West Side of Manhattan, and in other hospitals as well. Is there anybody in this room who went and had a self-test?
Some people might know that they don't have to do this because
they're cancer. It's very unlikely if people in your parents' age didn't even know about this. People didn't talk about it. Right? Alright? The fact is, like anything else, even though you tell me what's the cost, it's $15 to test it. What's $15 today? So you, a single day costs more than that, right? It depends what steward it is. Most people will not go to a hospital and do a procedure, even though it can be very helpful for them, if no one pushes it. You have the following alternatives. One is we could say we won't talk about the issue. Right? I guess maybe I'll lock up for sneaker guys or something, but otherwise we won't mention the Shiva at all. Tasak is not a people's mind now, there's a new issue, so that other thing. Won't talk about it. It's rare anyway. Or you talk about it. If you talk about it, then you have to decide to encourage people to do some procedure. Not just have a general talk. Right? When you encourage people to do something, different things are more effective than others. If I say, next Monday morning, we're going to have a nurse downstairs on the first floor. As soon as the swine sale closes, we'll take that room and we'll put nurses in the room and offer a test to everybody. Genetic test for Tay-Sachs and 42 and a half other genetic problems. Chances are we'll have many more people coming downstairs taking the test than going on their own to Mount Sinai, even if I tell them, you know, you can go to Mount Sinai and get the test anytime you want.
They oppose your encouraging
them to test, that's what they're saying,
those who oppose
the polls. They either think that those who oppose it say, it's very rare, it's going to cause problems, don't bring it up. Unless there's a reason to suspect it. So the assumption is that if a person knows, talking about genetics, right, if a person knows that in his family he had a cousin who had a Tay-Sachs baby, so that should, you know, ring a bell saying, uh-oh, there must be carriers in the family. And the genes in the family, I better go get tested. But in general, but not as individuals. So therefore, once you start, there are endless genetic imperfections. Yes?
Two questions. How many, or what percentage of the ones you went for the test? How many? And secondly, how is it that the majority term is it, for instance, is it spreading widely? Are people taking the test or
It's a few hundred people took it over a couple of times here, which is really not a tremendous percentage because our population changes. Federally, people are graduating, new people are coming. In certain circles, it's extremely successful. Certain communities. In the Hasidic community, I don't know if every Hasidic community, in a Hasidic community where authority plays a major role. So I have inside here, for example, something from Baltimore, where do I have it here yet? Baltimore Committee of Chevra Dar Yesharim, where it was a fairly small community, and they described the procedure completely. Alright? And they were also then close it with a psalm with a whole bunch of names saying, that one page is a psalm with a bunch of Hashashivas saying, the Darishan procedure is wonderful and everybody should use it. Which either does or doesn't impact upon people. Now, depending on what community you have, these names, you know, mean to people in that community. They also, I should have added the argument, but they have it here, add the argument that if there's any controversy around a procedure, people get afraid to do it. They're reluctant to do it. If they felt that this procedure will get the approval of all the Rabbanim, all the Rosh Yeshivas, so everyone will say, this is a procedure that's approved, that's desired, that will mean people simply do it. And any procedure where there's a question, people say, you know, I'm machmir. We're here machmir being, not really halachically machmir, but not doing something. Since it's always much easier not to do something than to do it. You want to do it. I was told by the fellow in Darisharian that there is a number already in two digits, between above 10 and less than 100, people where there were matches, where they were able to tell people beforehand. They did get involved in a situation, which is a very difficult and touchy one, of people who tested after they were already committed to each other. And they tried to talk people out of getting married. The fellow who was the power behind Darisharim himself and his wife had a number of Tay-Sachs babies before anybody knew anything about any of it. And they didn't know that it was genetic either. She had one, so fluke, good charm. Right? And he, from his perspective, he will try to prevent a couple the day before they get married, because he thinks that the effect of having sex with the baby is so terrible that it's better to break up the ship. Right? Yeah.
The Dory Shuttering program, is that, you mentioned that there are like numerous genetic diseases, do they just have adopted?
No, they start increasing the number of diseases that they detect.
So when they have two numbers, do they like...
They will cut on everything. It's easy enough, right?
But I mean, if one of these takes that, there's no problem. If it's another genetic...
They will be, they'll get more explicit. Okay. And if they ask, they say there's a problem, they won't just say there's a problem, they'll say what problem it is. That's right. Yeah.
You said that the test is very, the disadvantage is that it's very cumbersome. But that's also a big advantage because if let's say they both turn out to be positive, which is very, it's only 1 in 900, right? Because 1 in 30 is
very. By the way, I should point out that apparently in certain categories, apparently in Satmar it's 1 in 10 and it's 1 in 100.
Right.
It's more common, which is one of the reasons. Aside from the others that I mentioned, that their testing procedure is much more effective in that community. Because the awareness of the possibility of having a taste, if knowing someone had a taste sex baby certainly causes people to be much more concerned about it. And one of the reasons I'm very concerned is because I do know a young couple that had a taste sex baby. Right? And therefore, very much became real to me. Statistics, 1 in 900, 1 in 100, that doesn't impact. One case, of course, it does. Yeah.
But it's also a big advantage because let's say you have a couple, they call up whatever point, and they say, yes, there's a problem. So now they know they're carriers. Now the next time, okay, so let's say they break it up, now they go out again. When this guy or girl goes out with the next counterpart, he doesn't have to say, well, look, I'm a carer. He doesn't have to say he knows anything. He can just say, let's put in our numbers. So the whole process that he could insert himself into without revealing anything again.
Okay. I think it's an important point. He says, knowing one's a carrier is traumatic on that level. Right? However, on a second level, if I know it through getting a match, I do not have to tell anybody I'm a carrier. I get the match again. The only thing is the next match not to match, and everything's okay. While if I know the information, and I have to ask them, if I'm a carrier, you're a carrier too. No. To ask somebody if they're a carrier. If you're messing with them. Now, the difference is, why are you asking me? Right here. Why should they give the information that you are in a situation where you have to be more open about it? Yes?
You're kind of preventing what the Shimon wants to know as a carrier. You get from the grapevine, someone was a carrier and don't match his number, and everybody can match their number against that number.
No, the number is just a number for, like a social security number.
Yeah, I understand, but if friends know about one person who found out that he was a carrier,
right.
Then anybody who wants to find out that they're a carrier can match their number against his and pretend that that was shit up.
Oh. Yeshiva Brachim are so clever, or such good trades, depending on how you want to look at it, that one has to be concerned about that also. Like maybe the boy number start with B and the girl number start with G, I don't know. I'll have to ask someone. Yes?
I'm just curious about the amount of money it costs to run for your show.
Well, they charge for the testing, so they really are going to tell them that. No. What happened is they try to make it free, but they discovered that then there is a deficit. And one of the peculiar things in life is that people take much more seriously things that they pay for. if I could, you know, move to from contemporary halacha to advise people who are going to be in Rabban or in Chinuch, you know, running an adult education program in the community, most people who advise you to have a charge to participate in the program. People take it more seriously, especially if it's a single lecture, maybe not make a difference. But if you say it's a class, and there's a charge for it, even if the charge is ridiculously low, people are more likely to come regularly if they're paying for it than if they're doing a favor coming. That's been tested in different ways. Yes. Well, I think it's a short lecture. I think I have some questions. Yes.
I'm glad that the article is from Rabbi Wallenberg that he suggests that with two carriers, two detectors, you should be dissuaded from marrying before they become engaged. And then he says that Judaism does not sanction a sterile union.
Okay, I didn't want to get into all of our advice opinions on different things. What I think Rabbi Bleich meant, and I don't want to know, Kai Chuck. If a couple came to me and she was diabetic, right, which means it's extremely difficult for her to have a child, they certainly were committed to get married. Now, however, there is a question, though. For example, if since we file a Chengra Ben Gershon, we only have one wife, and if a couple is sterile for 10 years, but they can't have any children, there is a notion that once you try to have children, perhaps they should marry someone who can have children. I think what he's referring to was using birth control methods simply to not have any children because of the risk that one of the children will be taken. You have to ask him precisely what he meant. But that by itself would be a justification to using birth control. And he would say, no, the halakhic system is not based on having sterile marriages and not having any children. Does that help at all?
He may have shot
something with, you know, a shotgun, something with, you know, very small animal. Since people are starting to leave, it's always better to leave them wanting more. We'll stop here.
No,